This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. Today we're broadcasting from the Newseum, just off the Mall, here in Washington, D.C. It's a beautiful, brand-new museum of journalism with interactive exhibits, state-of-the-art studios, and a breathtaking view of the Capitol. The permanent exhibition here includes printing presses, typewriters and cameras, famous front pages and photographs, hundreds of hours of archival footage. There's a satellite truck and a news helicopter and eight concrete sections of the Berlin Wall. In the atrium, suspended from the ceiling, is the biggest television screen I've ever seen, 880 square feet. The museum opens to the public on Friday. Today is press preview day. We're in the night studio with colleagues from newspapers, magazines, television networks, and websites to talk about this remarkable election and the ever-changing media. There are more ways than ever to hear what the candidates say, to see what they've done, and no shortage of opinion. From analysts, columnists, and bloggers, we've gathered some of the best and most interesting to talk about their roles in this campaign. Of course, we also want to hear from you. What do you expect from media coverage of politics? Is the media living up to your expectations, or maybe down to them? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. And you can email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We'll be taking questions from our audience here at the museum as well. Later on in the hour, we'll talk with the reporters who exposed poor care at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Yesterday, their stories in the Washington Post won the Pulitzer Prize for public service. But first, journalism and the campaign. Joining us on the panel are Anna Marie Cox, Washington editor of Time.com. She's also Wonkette Emeritus, as she puts it, founding editor of Wonkette Blog. Anna Marie Cox, always good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
William Crystal is the editor of the Weekly Standard and a columnist for the New York Times. Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Neil.
Clarence Page writes a syndicated column for the Chicago Tribune. Good to have you back on the program, Clarence.
Me too, Neil. Thank you.
And Jerry Seib is executive Washington editor and assistant managing editor of the Wall Street Journal. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Jerry. Neil.
Anna Marie Cox, let's start with you. What's your agenda as you follow the campaign? What are you trying to get done?
Wow, that's I'm glad you asked such an easy question.
That's our job here.
You know, I think that my bosses have the same question for me. It's a little bit of a, you know, I entered sort of an arranged marriage with Time. Neither of us quite knew what we would be getting from each other. I got an expense account, which I'm really happy with. And they got someone to cover the campaign that is sort of admittedly not doing a traditional kind of coverage. I sort of see myself as, I put it to someone the other day, live blogging the campaign. Like, I'm not trying to do, like, well, actually, I'm not trying, I would admit that I'm not trying to do heavy-hitting policy coverage or trying to sort of play gotcha with candidates. I guess other people covering campaigns may not admit that, although that's what they're doing. But I think that it just is another layer of coverage. I mean, I think that the kind of things that bloggers are doing on the campaign trail is, maybe it's bad for the country and whatnot, but it's like the minute-to-minute coverage of a campaign rather than kind of the underlying, you know, narrative.
Well, famously,
it's the jingle as opposed to the narrative.
As Wonkette, 4 years ago, you got to cover the campaign in your slippers from your home. Do you now go out and follow the campaign and have to do all those things, terrible things that regular reporters have to do?
Sometimes. Actually, I spent a long time with the McCain campaign, and I don't think I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. I wound up covering the McCain campaign pretty much from April till he secured the nomination in January, on and off. And the dirty secret is that I got that assignment because no one else wanted it at the time.
Huh.
Because it was McCain. Of course, he was going to drop out at any second. So sort of by accident, I got to see a campaign really, like, from when I started covering it, and there was just five people in a van, not even a bus, to, you know, him winning, you know, getting the nomination. And I think that was, I mean, that definitely was an education. And I've been trying to sort of figure out what it means in terms of the next part of this adventure and how much it'll matter. The press played so much a part in the McCain recovery. It's hard to imagine what the next part will be like.
Let's go to Bill Crystal. And Bill Crystal, what are you trying to get done in this election campaign? And would readers be safe in assuming that your agenda is to see a John McCain elected president?
I prefer that John McCain be elected president, but I'm trying to put out a decent magazine and cover the campaign interestingly and entertainingly, and I think we've actually, you know, we've covered obviously not just Senator McCain, but the other Republicans, and in fact Senator Clinton and Senator Obama, and I think some people have been surprised that Steve Hayes went out and wrote one of the early pieces saying that Obama was really an impressive and formidable candidate. So, no, you just try to report it as it is. Obviously, we're a mixture of reporting and analysis and opinion, so it's a little different from what, you know, the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal do, well, or at least a little different from what they admit that they do. So couldn't resist that. You know, how could I not? But, yeah, I think people overstate, frankly, how much people have agendas. I mean, obviously, we have our views of things, but really, we're all interested in politics, and it's hard enough to understand. I mean, the main task is simply to understand what's happening, to try to have a grasp of the dynamics, to try to figure out what might happen in the near future, as opposed to sort of, I mean, we have very limited ability to make something happen, you know. The American public are not waiting to hear my judgment of who should be the next president of the United States.
Some campaigns are inevitably more interesting than others. This one has been just a house of fire right from the start. Are you more jazzed about covering this campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was always going to be interesting. It's an interesting moment in American history and world politics. It's the first campaign without an incumbent president running for re-election or an incumbent vice president seeking to step up since 1952. So it's like an open seat congressional or gubernatorial or Senate election. It's just there's more variability, more fluidity, more unpredictability, interesting primaries in both parties. And for the first time in a long time, the Republicans will nominate someone who was not the top fundraiser. He was outspent by both Giuliani and Romney, was sort of the establishment candidate at the beginning, but then after the implosion wasn't. To some degree, Giuliani and Romney, I would say, shared that. So it's very heartening, actually, that the establishment cannot always muscle its way to a victory. Money doesn't always count. And, of course, on the Democratic side, we have a genuine upset. I mean, I myself, I think, was pretty early in seeing that Obama had a good chance and was slightly ridiculed for this, I would say, by lots of friends in Washington late last, you know, maybe August, September, October, when I said I thought it was 50-50 that Obama could beat Clinton. But again, he now has raised more money, but he certainly started off as an underdog and not the favorite of the establishment. So how often do you get two exciting primaries, very interesting and unorthodox candidates, obviously a whole bunch of first African-American, first woman. McCain would be the oldest man elected president for the first time. Romney was the first Mormon. So, I mean, in many, many ways, a really unusual race.
Jerry Seib, let me turn to you. You work for the Wall Street Journal. Does the Wall Street Journal have an agenda, and does it have an institutional agenda in this campaign?
We have an agenda to write more. That's our agenda, I think, right now. I mean, you know, I was thinking as you were asking the question of what are you trying to do at covering this campaign, and I think what we're trying to do is more for a variety of reasons. I mean, this is, as Bill said, a phenomenally interesting campaign. I mean, I've been involved in one way or another covering every presidential campaign since 1980 when I was 12, I think, at that point. And this is just going away the most interesting and unpredictable one. And so what we have found is that people are just fascinated, and they're fascinated by it, and they want to read about it in every conceivable venue. They want to read about it in print. They want to read about it online. They want to talk about it online. They want to read columns. They want to read news, and they want to read opinion. Mm-hmm. And we're putting that all out there, and it's all being sort of gobbled up. And that's really what I find to be the most fascinating thing. So I resumed writing a column, which I had done earlier, and it paused for a while, so I've resumed writing that. We do probably twice as many stories as we did the last campaign, I would say, in print. We have a campaign blog. We have a daily political analysis aggregator online. We're going to start an online group of columnists. And people are in the campaign. Readers are in the campaign. And I think that's basically, you know, you sort of boil it down to a very simple answer. People are interested. We're trying to be there to match the interest, which is incredibly high.
Mm-hmm. Clarence Page, like Bill Kristol, you're an opinion columnist. What's your agenda? What are you trying to get done in this campaign?
Well, I always remember late, great Mike Royko, my colleague at the Tribune years ago, said that the columnist's job is to explain things. Because, frankly, we don't have the space to really go into in-depth reporting. When I started this business, the average column was about 800 words. Now they're asking, you know, if you come in under 700, newspapers I'm syndicated to love it. We don't have the resources to do a lot of in-depth investigating. And besides, you know, I had to put out two of them a week. we do have the ability, the platform, to try to explain things, to give people an opinion for their viewpoint to bounce off of. And that, I think, is a service in itself, because people are just inundated with information these days and seem to appreciate the service. I try to get away from the horse race and get to the issues, of which there are many in this campaign. But Bill Kristol is right. You know, the narrative of these characters in this drama is so appealing. I feel like I think it was Michael Corleone in The Godfather who said, every time I try to get out, like, they keep pulling me back in. Hmm. You know, the soap opera keeps pulling you back in, this horse race between Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John McCain.
Well, Clarence, just to borrow another quote, this is the life you have chosen.
Thank you, my friend. You are so right.
Let's get a question from the audience here at the museum. Over to my left.
Hi, my name is Pamela Gentry, and I'm with BET News. And I wanted to ask the panelists if they've noticed any increase or what the impact that they've seen from citizen journalists, those folks who are writing on the Internet that are not necessarily tied to formal news organizations.
Anna Marie Cox, you're the only one I know who reads the Internet up here.
I think there's been a lot of different projects that have attempted to harness the ground-level interest that people have in the campaign. Huffington Post has a, I think, rather cleverly named project called Off the Bus, which asks people who are normal citizens to weigh in on the campaign and to go to campaign events and report on what they've seen there. I was thinking before the panel started, and Clarence said something that reminded me of this, that I'm not sure if people are being inundated with information so much as they are with opinion. Because that's a lot of what I see when I read blogs, because opinion is a lot easier to manufacture than information. And that's what's interesting about this Off the Bus project, because they're actually asking people to leave their home. That's a big deal for a blogger, you know. Mm-hmm. I know.
We just have a few seconds left. Jerry Seiber, is the Wall Street Journal doing anything with citizen journalism?
Not per se, but what is interesting is if you open up anything you put online to reader comments, you essentially get it. And you get it in dozens and hundreds of pieces every day, every hour sometimes.
Stay with us. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking with our guests. They are Anna Marie Cox, William Kristol, Clarence Page, and Jerry Seib. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the Newseum in Washington, D.C. We're here with a distinguished panel of reporters, bloggers, and editors. Anna Marie Cox is the Washington editor of Time.com. William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard. Clarence Page writes a syndicated column for the Chicago Tribune. Jerry Seib is executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal. And of course, we want to hear from you about your expectations of them. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. This time last year, the press had written John McCain off, and on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton's political obituary was written at least three times in the last year.
I'm not saying that she's destined to lose here, but unless the dynamic changes greatly, she's going to come out of here having lost two in a row.
If anybody saw Saturday Night Live, you know, maybe we should ask Barack if he's comfortable and needs another pillow.
So is the media treating you fair, Ron Paul?
I think all politicians think we could be treated better by the media. They say, why don't you get as much time as others?
You know a lot of these kids.
I know. John's not getting a lot of time. Let me just respond
you
to this.
I
feel pretty bad. I do.
Candidates responding to questions about coverage on the campaign trail. Let's get another question. Let's go to the phones. This is, I have to hit the right computer. That would be good. Brian with us from Portland. Is that Portland, Oregon?
Yeah, Portland, Oregon.
Go ahead, please.
My comment was, I listen to the radio a lot for my news, and I get an awful lot of coverage of the horse race of the campaign. And that's all the analysis is, the analysis of who might vote for who. And I'm a voter. I'm not running the campaign. I want analysis of what the candidate's policy positions might mean to me and what the candidate's strengths might mean to me. But the coverage of the horse race really drowns out any substantive analysis of who I should vote for.
Anna Marie Cox?
I'd be curious if Jerry has seen this phenomenon as well, but we have a blog, political blog at Time called Swampland, time.com/swampland. And we tend to focus on the horse race. We're a bunch of political journalists. That's what interests us. And we opened it up to comments about a year ago, actually. And every time you write something like sort of the trajectory of what it means for Mark Penn to be leaving or something from the Hillary campaign, you get commenter after commenter saying how angry they are, how upset they are, how disappointed they are that we're not covering the issues. The issues, the issues, the issues, the issues. Finally, I guess it was probably 6 months ago, I wrote about the candidate's, you know, environmental policies. You know how many comments it got?
Two?
Yeah, I mean, just not very many at all. So, I mean, I appreciate that people say that they want coverage of the issues and coverage of policy, but it's not like people in the media are just making some kind of top-down decision to cover horse race. It seems like that's actually also what people read.
Mm-hmm. Bill Kristol, are there issues? Well, I guess we're at this point talking about just the Democratic side, because that's the only race going at the moment. But obviously, between the Democrats and the Republicans, there are a lot of issues.
Yeah, but in a primary contest, actually, there tend not to be as many issues. Certainly, on the Democratic side this time, there haven't been big issues. And I think, to the degree, you know, there just aren't that fundamental differences between Obama and Clinton. They try to manufacture occasionally, you know, a big difference in health care plans, but basically they are both, you know, have moderate to liberal Democratic positions on pretty much everything. There's not great heterodoxy on the part of either one. Neither one is pro-life or pro-war or pro-Bush tax cut or whatever would be a dramatic departure from the party. The party's actually pretty united, so I think it just makes it would. Journalism would run out pretty fast if one really got into the. I mean, are there differences between Clinton's and Obama's positions on the environment? I doubt if they're
very
terribly
mild. Yeah.
Very mild. So now, and I think on the issues where there have been differences, are differences, or have been differences, which one of the candidates is now moving on, let's say Senator Clinton on the war, that's gotten a lot of coverage. So I guess I would think if you are a Democratic primary voter, you have a pretty good feel of what their views are on most issues and the few issues where one of them arguably has been a little different from the other on, you know, Iran sanctions or something like that.
Healthcare, yeah.
Healthcare a little bit. On the Republican side, there were more obviously real differences. There was a pro-choice candidate. There was an anti-war candidate, Ron Paul. There was, you know, real differences in economic philosophy between Huckabee, let's say, and Romney, McCain, somewhere in between. But again, I think those got covered, maybe not in the detail that some might have wanted. On the other hand, I don't know. I guess I would think a pretty attentive viewer or listener or reader would get a pretty good feel of where these candidates were on the basic issues.
Brian, any particular issue that you'd want to hear more about?
My most important issue is environmentalism, and I do search out what I can about that. But I'm just a little frustrated that it's treated like a sporting event, and it's not treated like news.
All right, Brian, thanks very much for the call. Now, I can understand your frustration. Thanks very much for getting to us. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. Let's go to Jerry, and Jerry's with us from South Miami in Florida.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead, please.
Hello? Hi.
Yes, you're on.
In July of 2004, when I retired, a colleague gave me a book by Paul Waldman called Fraud, The Strategy Behind the Bush Lies and Why the Media Didn't Tell You. He's got a new one out now. On McCain and how the media is giving him a free ride, same thing all over again. I personally have heard McCain say on Russert's program once, he's a Ronald Reagan Republican, he's a Theodore Roosevelt Republican. Those two are diametrically opposed. Reagan was absolutely opposed to everything that Roosevelt stood for. Roosevelt was progressive. McCain absolutely is not. I also remember when I was still working, I was certified financial planner, I saw what happened with the savings and loans. McCain was one of the Keating Five, and he's trying to claim, he's sort of lived that down. By the way, and I was supporting him in 2000. But he's done the same thing. He took money from Keating and voted to give him a break. More recently, there was...
And I do think, Jerry, that story was got some prominence again in the New York Times not all that long ago.
Let me
just ask Clarence Page, do you think John McCain is getting a free ride from the media?
Yes, and he's getting a free ride partly because there's no story on his side of the ballot right now because there's so much action with the Democrats. I've seen the book that the caller refers to, and I think these issues are going to come out. I offer him some consolation. It's April. We're a long way to November. And the campaign really, as far as Republicans versus Democrats go, really launches after Labor Day. And that's where we certainly saw, like with the swift voting of John Kerry, began like in August, as I recall, and Kerry didn't pay that much attention to it for a couple of weeks because in August nothing is supposed to happen. As my fellow panelists have mentioned, everything is different this year. And there are issues available, by the way, at the websites of the various newspapers and candidates, but it is hard to get people to go and read them.
And Anna-Marie Cox, did John McCain get easier treatment from the media because of that charm, the straight talk express, his willingness to come back and just talk with reporters?
I would say that he definitely benefits from that charm and charisma that he has. Although I would also say that I think that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton would also benefit from spending a lot of time with journalists as well. It's just sort of a human nature. The more you spend time with someone, the more subjects you cover, the more, you know, the more kindly you tend to look at them, and the more willing you are to not play the gotcha game, which is usually what day-to-day campaign coverage, you know, comes down to.
Mm-hmm. Let me see. Jerry Seib, do you think John McCain gets a free ride in the Wall Street Journal?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I do think, I agree that he probably has benefited over time, and this is the course of his career over time, not the last couple of months, from the fact that he has a relationship with the press which is, frank and open and more than your average politician. I agree entirely with the human nature aspect of this. I'm always mystified by candidates who don't engage the press and then are surprised when their coverage seems stilted or unfair. It is a human nature thing, but you have to remember that in this campaign we in the press have been equally accused of being too soft on John McCain and too soft on Barack Obama. I'm not sure that after a couple of weeks of Reverend Jeremiah Wright that Barack Obama feels that way anymore. These things do tend to go in cycles. I mean, candidates rise, they become serious, they're taken more seriously, they get frisked hard by the press, and that's when that sort of, oh, you're too soft on them feeling kind of goes away. It tends to happen regularly.
Mm. Speaking of Reverend Wright, Clarence Page, race has become an important issue in this campaign.
That's what I've noticed.
Yeah. Certainly, candidate Obama has tried to do one of those political jujitsu moves and transform the issue from whatever his former pastor, the excerpts of what his former pastor said in some sermons, to a broader discussion of race. Is race, do you think, as a result, going to be an issue in this campaign?
Well, it's always been an issue. We just are never honest about it, and that's really why I said at the beginning of Obama's campaign that we're going to learn a lot about ourselves as Americans. A couple of my readers immediately sent me emails accusing me of saying that if you don't vote for Obama, you're a racist. I was talking about overall the fact that election campaigns are times for national debate and discussion and self-examination. And this one, we're, as has been mentioned, we're examining a lot of different things. But Barack Obama initially was received deserved praise for transcending race, whatever that means. And it seems to mean something in everybody's mind, mean a different thing. I think a lot of people thought it meant, hey, he's going to take race off the table. I won't have to worry about race anymore. I don't have to feel guilty as a white person. I don't have to feel like I'm a victim as a black person, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, that's dreaming. If race was that easy, we would have solved the whole dilemma a long time ago. The fact is, Obama knew he was going to have to address race sooner or later. He didn't know it was going to be over his pastor. First time in history that I know of that a candidate's come under fire for something their pastor said. But that's the kind of year this is. And so now Obama is trying to launch a national conversation on race, because the only way you can remove the race card from politics, the only way you can transcend it, is for people to understand when they're being played. And Americans are learning slowly but surely how you can get played by the race card. And I think, is there enough time in this campaign? I don't know. We will see. But Obama's done a service, I think, in at least getting it started.
Bill Kristol?
Well, Obama knew that Reverend Wright was a problem. He didn't invite him to his launch of his campaign in February of 2007. So the idea that Obama had no idea that there was something problematic about the Reverend whose church he had attended for two decades is obviously false. Now, you can say it's unfair or that Obama, there's no evidence he agreed with Reverend Wright, et cetera, but they chose not to invite him to the launch in Springfield in February of 2007. So he knew perfectly well that Wright was a problematic figure for some people. And I think, in fact, Obama, correctly, has no interest in having a national conversation on race. He'd be perfectly happy if it never comes up in the rest of the campaign. And the genius of his speech was that he, while saying he didn't use the term, but while sort of suggesting we have to have a serious grown-up discussion about race, he gave an extremely effective speech, which at least for the Democratic primary has basically put the issue of right away. You know, Senator Clinton's not going to attack Senator Obama on that. She made one comment, I guess, about how she herself would have left the church if the minister had been saying those things, and basically the whole thing subsided. I would say, just on this question of bias, the Democrats, I sort of preferred Obama in the sense that I think it would be healthier for the country to have a general election without the Clintons sort of resurfacing somehow. I mean, to have it just straightforward, you know, moderate liberal versus moderate conservative election, Obama, McCain, I just think would be a sort of healthier debate in some way. But on the other hand, I'm probably closer to Clinton on the issues, so I'm somewhat ambivalent about the Democrats. She's a little more moderate and hawkish, I think, than Obama. But I will say this, so trying to be objective, because I don't have a dog in that fight, I think the press has been unfair to Hillary Clinton, I'd say, of all the candidates so far. She has really had a tough time. The press does prefer, Obama's run a masterful campaign. His team has been very good at handling the press. Maybe the Clinton team has brought some of this on themselves because of a certain standoffishness and arrogance towards the press. I don't know. But I do think every time she says something slightly problematic, there was this recent incident with a hospital in Ohio where right away everyone decided she had made up the story or mischaracterized it. It turns out she had pretty much characterized it correctly. She had maybe the campaign had slightly been confused on which hospital this woman was turned away from. I think Geraldine Ferraro, before she became so notorious for saying what I think was a rather innocuous thing, but anyway, I was on a panel with her, and I was struck. I mean, she's an experienced political figure, and she's for Clinton, of course, but she was really bitter about the treatment of Senator Clinton, and I don't think she was entirely wrong.
Bill Kristol of the Weekly Standard and the New York Times, also with us Clarence Page, syndicated columnist with the Chicago Tribune, Anna Marie Cox, the Washington editor of Time.com, and Jerry Seib, who is the assistant managing editor of the Wall Street Journal. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to a question from here at the museum.
Hi, I'm Whitney Spivey from the National Press Foundation, and I'm wondering, is online journalism driving print journalism in this campaign or vice versa?
Who's driving whom? Well, Anna Marie, I'm turning to you.
I somehow know that I'm going to get these questions about online journalism, whereas I actually think that the Wall Street Journal has done is actually a pioneer of sorts in that they perfectly integrated their online coverage and their paper coverage. And so actually, I would like to, why don't you take this one?
Okay.
And Anna, you could host the next couple of hours.
I'll use a word I hate here, but I actually think they're becoming organic. I mean, in other words, I can't distinguish anymore. I mean, I start my day at 5:15 in the morning, honestly, combing through online coverage from the night before, looking for things to put on our political analysis aggregator. And then that sort of feeds into decisions we make about stories that we're going to write for that day. Often it feeds into the column that I'm going to write for print, which then goes online. And it all kind of is supplemented by what we do during the day on something we call washwire.com, which is an online political blog that runs 24/7. So I don't know where the line is there. And you know what? I really don't care anymore. I honestly have decided it doesn't matter. And if you go back and look at some of the stories that we've done in print or online that have gotten the highest levels of readership, some of them were online first, some of them were in print first, some of them ran on the front page of the paper, some of them ran inside the paper. In many cases, the big numbers of readers were driven to them online, which is where people who eat up politics seem to be eating up politics this time. So I think it's an interesting question. It's one I spend less and less time worrying about, honestly.
Clarence Page, you want to get
in? Very quickly. You know, when I worked in TV, I was gratified, coming from newspapers to TV, I was gratified to see every morning the TV assignment desk reading the newspapers to see what to cover that day or to get an idea. And then in the evening, back in the newspaper newsroom, everybody watched the evening news to see what our readers would perceive the news to be. Because readers tend to perceive, when they talk about media, they're really talking about television. So, you know, which drives the other? They both drive each other. And so the same is true of online. It is organic. Anybody who presumes that one medium drives another medium presumes that we actually have a system in the news business. Let me disabuse you of that notion. Daily news is a daily business. It is run by judgment calls every day. If you get a tip on the web, you're going to go with it. If you get a tip on TV from real live people, you're going to go with it. And everybody watches everybody else to see what's happening. And so they all have an influence on each other.
But also the distinction just doesn't hold up anymore. I mean, as Jerry and Anna Marie said, I mean, people put things, and we're a weekly journal of news and opinion, so we're less under deadline pressure for most of our articles. If something is sensitive, we put it up on the website. And of course, we do have a lot of stuff on the website, on the blog, and daily articles, and of course, all the major news organizations now do. I think a big moment, this is a museum-type issue, which someone should have a serious scholarly panel on. I suspect historians might look back, the moment when the New York Times, with its huge alleged scoop about Senator McCain, leaving aside whether it was a real scoop, but on McCain and lobbyists, and when they put that up online at 2 in the afternoon, rather than holding it for the morning paper, which is absolutely the traditional thing you do, that, I think, is a moment where the whole notion of the daily newspaper starts to collapse.
That was William Crystal. Our thanks, too, to Anna Marie Cox, Clarence Page, and Jerry Seib. We'll talk Pulitzers in just a moment. This is NPR News.